BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello. Hello. I'm John Ronson. Welcome to a bonus episode of Things Fell Apart. So usually we make the season, 8 stories, you know, very kind of highly produced, like little dollhouses, and then we'll do a couple of bonus episodes. And usually I'm being interviewed by somebody. It's been Louis Theroux, Adam Buxton, and Dolly Alderton, all brilliant. But this time we thought we would do something different, and you will be the interviewer. So you can just please ask me anything you like, anything at all. Nothing's off grounds. Anything. There's a gentleman over there. Hello.
Hiya. What's your favourite dinosaur?
What's my favourite dinosaur?
No, two-part question, sorry. Scratch the dinosaur one.
Velociraptor. Is that an actual dinosaur, or did I just imagine
it? Sounds fantastic. Okay. No, you worked with all these crazy people in the clan and jihadis and everything like that. Do you think you were given a massive and wonderful head start by being in Frank Sidebottom's band?
I was in the Frank Sidebottom Oh Blimey big band for 2 or 3 years in the 1980s. Do people know? Frank Sidebottom, he wore a big fake head that he never took off. And I was his keyboard player. The answer to your question is yes. Because nothing makes a young man feel more alive and on an adventure than driving down the M6 at 3 o'clock in the morning, sitting next to a man wearing a big fake head. That was my early entry into shadowy worlds, like Alice Through the Looking Glass. And it did give me the appetite to have more adventures. It did. It was the first time I'd gone through the looking glass.
I think you're working with the absurd and the crazy and the slightly mad genius, aren't you?
He was a mad genius. You know, sometimes he would leave the head on the whole time. His real name was Chris, but you weren't allowed to call him Chris when he had the head on. You had to call him Frank. If you said, that was a good show, Chris, you'd just get a blank stare. I mean, literally a blank stare. But if you said, that was a good show, Frank, he'd go, oh, thank you very much. So, yeah. Tell you something else about him. One of my big memories of Frank was when he did take the head off, to get the voice, he would wear a nose peg and talk about suffering for your art. He would take the head off and he would, like, turn away, you know, shyly. And you'd see him take the nose peg off and squint in agony. So being Frank Sidebottom was physically painful, but he did it for us. And I would argue that me hanging out with the Ku Klux Klan is physically painful, but I do it for you. Hi.
How do you find the stories that you're going to follow up and select which are the best to go into a series?
It's one of my favourite parts of the process. And I'm here, by the way, with Sarah Shebbier, my brilliant Things Fell Apart producer. Sarah, would you like to stand up and wave? Well, I'll tell you how I found the Excited Delirium story, because that's a good example. For season two of Things Fell Apart, season one takes place over 50 years. It's the origin stories of culture wars from the 1960s through to lockdown. Season two, I decided to try and do something different, so I wanted to make every episode about things that spiraled during lockdown, all the culture wars. And we realised through the research that so many of the culture wars that consume us today all sprung up within 20 days of each other. So for the first 6 weeks of lockdown, we were all passive and compliant, and then we became like coiled springs. And we lost faith in our institutions, and we lost faith in our neighbours, and everybody became more paranoid. And part of the reason why I wanted to make season two was because I thought that this really hasn't been thought about enough. We went through some really weird shit in 2020. Like, nothing like that had ever happened in our lifetimes. And what was that doing to us? What was that doing to our psychology? So that's really why I wanted to make season two. And George Floyd had been murdered during that period on May the 25th. And so I thought I'd want to try and tell a George Floyd story. But the last thing I want to do is tell a story that's been told before. So what I did was I downloaded every audiobook I could find about George Floyd, from really bad ones to this very good book called His Name is George Floyd. And I lived most of the time in upstate New York. So I went for a very long hike, like a 20-mile hike, listening to these things, just looking for a gem, whatever that is. And the gem was, there's a very brief mention, and his name is George Floyd, of excited delirium. It comes and goes in a sentence. But I just thought, huh, that's something I don't understand that I would like to understand. Those are dissonant words. I don't know what those words mean, but they're strange words to be found in this book. So I just wrote down the words excited delirium, just went down a massive rabbit hole until eventually we found the story of the Miami murders. And many of my stories come that way, just from two words in an academic paper. I mean, much of my book, The Psychopath Test, I found that way and so on. Hi.
Hi there. I really enjoyed the series. It was fantastic.
Thank
you. The thing I kind of really took from it was you get all these really developed and kind of ingrained conspiracy theories, and then in one small episode you kind of pop them like a balloon and realise there's nothing behind them. It's just all misunderstanding. So if it's so easy to explain, as you've done, why there's nothing in them, why do they persist?
It's one of the great mysteries of our times. You know, why do people fall for things that clearly aren't true? I think there's many answers. One answer is narcissism. This is like an unpleasant answer because you don't want to just label people with a mental disorder. But the fact is, lots of social scientists have done studies on the relationship between narcissism and, I'd say, conspiratorial leadership, not necessarily the rank and file. But narcissists want to be the smartest people in the room. And quite often the way to do that is to come up with counterintuitive information that nobody else has. And quite often the way to do that is to come up with conspiracy theories. Also, narcissists don't really care very much about the truth because they're more important than the truth. I'm probably the first person ever to interview Alex Jones, America's leading conspiracy theorist and presenter of The One Show. And I snuck into the secret club with him called Bohemian Grove back in the 90s. I'm kind of like, I hate to say this, but I'm kind of like Alex Jones' Simon Cowell. And people have asked me over and over again, like, does he mean it or is he a showman? And I think actually there's a third answer. And the third answer is he's a narcissist and it doesn't matter. The truth doesn't matter. So I think that's part of the reason why leaders of conspiratorial movements do what they do. But people who then believe, people who come along and believe, I think a lot of it's just to do with this kind of knee-jerk world that we're living in, where we just define ourselves as being in opposition to other people, where we're in these echo chambers, our beliefs are being reinforced by people who believe the same stuff that we do, and we become very dogmatic. And by the way, I don't think this is just like your crazy right-wing conspiracy theories. This is happening all over the place. It's happening in the mainstream world. It's happening on the left. Oh. Hello.
Hi there. As someone who's read some of your work, I personally am really disappointed to see you standing there calling people conspiracy theorists.
Oh, okay.
Because we can see that some of the conspiracy theories, chemtrails were a conspiracy theory. We can see them. While we were in lockdown, loads of 5G towers went up everywhere without safety certificates that are dangerous. You can sit there, whoever's laughing, I don't care. With regard to the vaccine, so say vaccine, lots of people have been killed by the vaccine. I know somebody that's, her husband died, a 33-year-old doctor, her husband died from the vaccine. Just an example. It's not a conspiracy. Let me just finish what I've got to say, please. I'm just going to say what I've got to say. In other examples, the World Economic Forum, that's not a conspiracy theory. The World Health Organization pandemic treaty, they tried to bring
can
in.
I do need to stop you because I really do think you've made your point.
Yeah. This will be going on the BBC, yeah.
Can I just say that is a conspiracy theory? The reason why I stopped you wasn't because it's the BBC and we need to silence these dangerous truths. The reason why I stopped you, to be completely honest, is because it can get irksome for somebody to give a long statement instead of ask a question in situations like this. You said the World Economic Forum, and in fact I make an episode about this in season 2 of Things Fell Apart. So the thing that people go on about all the time about the World Economic Forum is that they say, you know, you'll own nothing and you'll be happy. That's something that anti-World Economic Forum people go on about all the time. They want us to own nothing and be happy. They want us all to live in pods and eat bugs. 15-minute cities. And on the right... Exactly, but when you look, have you heard the episode of Things Fell Apart where I look into this? Well, please do listen to it, because everything I just said, we scrutinise and we look at the truth of it. So, for instance, there was this Danish politician, Ida Auken, who was asked to write a thought experiment for the World Economic Forum, which she didn't even agree with herself. It's like, okay, nobody owns cars, we all have to take Ubers. What would the future society be like? It was a thought experiment essay that was badly presented by the World Economic Forum, so they're partly responsible for it. But it's not a conspiracy to take away everybody's possessions. It was an essay imagining the future. So now her life is an absolute misery because of the echo chamber turning all of these things into something that they're not. She wants you to own nothing and be happy. And so the 15-Minute Cities, this poor guy called Duncan Enright, who was like an Oxfordshire councillor, he had an idea for bus lanes in Oxford, because Oxford, as you know, is an old city with crooked roads. So he has an idea for bus lanes, so he would like ease the traffic. People had placards on marches with Duncan's face on them saying he wants to keep us enslaved in his 15-minute city. These are real lives of people who were just trying to do something ordinary, like think about bus lanes. I absolutely agree with you that sometimes mainstream society gets things wrong. There's no doubt that in the horror of lockdown, the mainstream world made mistakes. I mean, there's no doubt. But to turn it into this uber conspiracy theory where real lives are getting ruined is dangerous. And one very last thing I want to say is that, look, you know, I talked about conspiracy theories on the left too, and conspiracy theories in the centre, and conspiracy theories in the legacy media. So it's not like I'm saying we're right and you're wrong. I'm saying this irrational thinking permeates all aspects of society. But when it is irrational, and when there's real victims, that's real. And so, you know, these are real human beings whose lives are getting upended because of ideology. And by the way, it's been on my mind. I really hope that you don't think that I was in any way condescending or shutting you up or anything. I'm just trying to run the talk. So, but I do apologise if anything that I said was like, you know, yeah, I want to say that. Who, where, what? There's a lady here who would like to... Oh, and there's somebody up there too. Hi.
Hi. You talked of the ripple effect of the longevity of some ideas and how long that can go. What importance do you put on the idea of having a catchy name?
A catchy name? Yeah. Like what? Like Things Fell Apart?
Yes, like Things Fell Apart, or The Excited Delirium. It's memorable, and therefore, right, does the idea catch on?
Yeah, that's a good point. I mean, you're right, Excited Delirium is a catchy name. You're kind of asking the wrong person, because I'm the worst person in the world to come up with catchy titles, by the way. I've never come up with a good title. I'm happy with Things Fell Apart. That comes from the Yeats poem. Things fall apart, the centre cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. And The Men's Day at Goats was my wife's idea, and she was drunk. Oh, there's a person over there. Hi.
Hi. I just wonder whether you felt the volume of conspiracy theories has increased, or just our awareness and the amount of evidence they leave, and they've just become more mobile and less localised.
Right. No, I think the volume has increased. When I wrote my book, Them, which was published in like 1999, 2000, it really was the first book to look at the relationship between conspiracy theories and religious and political extremism. That was like a new thought back then. The moment I knew that it was really proliferating was I was at the gym, I was on the elliptical, and it was 2016, so none of the screens were showing Hillary Clinton's speech. It was all showing Donald Trump's speech. And one of the screens, at one point when I was at the gym, by the way, was showing Hillary Clinton was giving a speech, and CNN was showing the footage of the empty podium from which Donald Trump would soon speak. So the mainstream media were so excited, so thrilled and aghast and shocked that they would rather show an empty lectern than Hillary Clinton. And, you know, we're surprised that he won. But yeah, I was at the gym and somebody said to Trump on the TV, "Are you going to go back on the Alex Jones show?" And he went, "Alex Jones, nice guy." And I thought, my God, of all the people I've interviewed, if you asked me which one do you think should have the ear of a future president, I wouldn't have said Alex Jones. So it became mainstream, and now everyone's a conspiracy theorist. It was very niche, and now it seems to be everywhere. Hi, oh God. I see like a number of hands and I just panic. I realise I would make a terrible Sophie in Sophie's Choice. I'd be, take both my children. Hi.
Me.
Yes.
Oh, hi. Your research is superb. Do you do it all yourself?
So the way it works with me and Sarah is this. This is that we basically make every episode of Things Fell Apart the same way. Basically, I think the original idea tends to be mine. So I'll come up with, like, Excited Delirium or Judy Mikovits. Sarah casts it. So Sarah will find the voices, the best people to talk, and she'll convince them to talk, which is, you know, one of the hardest and most painful parts of the process. So the actual research part is, I guess, a combination between the two of us. Hi.
Hello, John. Thank you so much for joining us today. And I just wanted to ask a question about your interviewing technique. At the start, you were saying how you speak with a lot of controversial characters. You might describe them as narcissists. How do you go about building up rapport with people and challenging them while still maintaining their engagement with the interview?
I think it's because I tend to try and meet people where they are. I'm very rarely going in with an agenda. I always think that if you fill your head with prejudgment or ideology or anger or confrontation, then there's no room for curiosity and empathy and compassion. And so by the time we talk to somebody, I'm really excited to talk to them. I'm very curious. I'm in a very fortunate position in life that I only tell stories that I want to tell. So by the time I approach somebody, I'm like, or Sarah approaches them and I'm, you know, talking to them, I'm really excited and curious. And I think that enthusiasm maybe rubs off on them a bit and they don't feel threatened. And yeah, and I think it's like my bumptious, open enthusiasm and curiosity just sort of makes people open up to me. And rightly so, because I'm not trying to trick them. Is anyone here old enough to remember Sir Robin Day? Yeah. I mean, he was like a hero as a kid. And, you know, then he passed the baton of adversarial confrontational journalism to Jeremy Paxman. And they're both geniuses at it. And this is partly self-serving what I'm about to say, because I'm just not a confrontational person. And so maybe this is just me making an excuse for why I don't do it. But the fact is, I love to watch it. But when does it actually work? When you're interviewing somebody and you're yelling at them and they're cornered and they've got their back against the wall, what will be revealed? All that's going to be revealed is how they respond to being yelled at when their back's against the wall, which isn't necessarily a revealing way to judge somebody. Yet, so much of the British media in particular is based on it. Adversarial journalism, confrontation and so on. Whereas meeting somebody on a level playing field, not hierarchical, with curiosity, I just think you get more stuff. And it's not performative. Hello.
Hi, John. I saw you talking to Adam Buxton in Cardiff last night, and you mentioned your favourite thing about journalism is you get to go to places where maybe you're not allowed to go all the time. I'm just wondering, when you come back from those places with the story, do you ever think maybe this story shouldn't go out because of the controversy around it, the subject matter? Is there a lot of evaluation after you come back from these places?
Personally, I'm very conflicted. Like, I don't like to go to dangerous places because, I'm not like an adrenaline junkie. But the story I told last night was being at Broadmoor after my book, The Psychopath Test. It used to be the Broadmoor Asylum for the Criminally Insane. And I was sitting inside Broadmoor and I said to a nurse, I said, God, I feel so lucky to be in Broadmoor. Like, this is amazing. And he kind of looked at me and said, well, we've got a spare bed if you like. So that is the best thing about it. But yes, it's true that, well, I mean, I worry about the ethics all the time, but once in a while it becomes like a big discussion. One example was Alex Jones, actually. I did something for This American Life about Alex Jones's teenage years. There was a rumour that I heard that people didn't know that when he was at school, he was a bully, like a pathologically violent bully, to the extent that a bunch of kids that he bullied lured him to a party in a barn and beat him half to death. And this was his origin story. He was the victim of a conspiracy, so he now wanted to become a conspiracy theorist. So I went and did that story, and I talked to people who he'd been at school with as a teenager. And I came back very conflicted about that. Like, I sure as hell wouldn't want people poking around Cardiff High School in 1983 to find out what I was doing when I was 15. And I said that to This American Life. And one of the producers tusked at me and said, well, what about his victims? So that's a good point. It's not just the person in the room. It's also the consequences of their actions.
Hi, John. Hello.
Hello.
It's sort of similar to what the gentleman was saying about conspiracy theories that aren't necessarily part of a bigger agenda, but they're just ones that we can all sort of get involved in. Like BBC Verified did a story a couple of weeks ago where some nails had been glued into a play park and the woman in the area posted about it. And then they sort of mapped that people across the country were sharing it, saying, oh, this was in the local park. And similarly with your episode about cat litter trays in schools,
yes.
These sort of non-glamorous ones that people go, oh, well, obviously I'm enraged by that. And they're not aware that they're sort of part of
absolutely. So suddenly, I'm sure you'll remember that suddenly everybody started talking about how children identifying as cats were being allowed in schools all over America to use the toilet in cat litter trays. And in fact, I've got a very short clip. Clip number 23. And so, with their shrimp ready to be grilled, they set up... I made such an effort to get all the numbering right. Let me see if I can find it. Give me 1 second. Just bear with me. Don't judge.
Little children.
Oh, here it is. Whoa.
Dress up as animals during the school day. They meow and they bark. And now schools are wanting to put litter boxes in the schools for these children to use. How is this sanitary?
And here's the hugely successful podcaster, Joe Rogan.
My friend, his wife, is a school teacher. And she works at a school that had to install a litter box in the girls' room because there is a girl who's a furry who identifies as an animal. And her mother badgered the school until they agreed to put a litter box in one of the stalls.
The writer always accusing the left of being an echo chamber. But what, one thing I really noticed when we were making Things Fell Apart is what an echo chamber the right is. You know, one podcaster starts talking about these litter boxes and the next thing you know, everyone's talking about it. Piers Morgan's going on about it. But nobody ever produced a single photograph of a litter box being used by a child furry to defecate in class. Like, if this was happening all over the place, then why were there no photographs? So we went on an odyssey to try and find a school that was allowing litter boxes in class, and we found one. And it was a school in California, and this is the reason why it happened.
Because of school shootings, you guys. Right? And I hate to just say it bluntly like that, but when I first started teaching, we didn't have these buckets in the classroom, but now every classroom has a bucket like this in there. That's the reality of school in America, right?
Ryan means that the buckets are emergency toilets in case students have to hide from a shooter for a long period.
So people being upset about our bucket video, they're upset about the wrong thing.
Let's think about this. Imagine a custodian going and cleaning litter boxes all day. Imagine kids who are already so self-conscious suddenly feeling comfortable enough to use the bathroom in a litter box in the classroom. It's just absurd.
So basically, if you missed that, schools in California do have litter boxes. And this may be where the rumor started. But it's not so children who identify as cats could use the litter box, which was, when you think about it, how likely is that? But it's because if there's a school shooting and the kids have to be locked down for a long period, then they'll have somewhere to use the toilet. So once again, we're worrying about the wrong thing. We yell at each other down here when the people up there, in this case maybe the NRA, are the ones who are wielding the real power and controlling us from up above. Hello.
Hi.
Hi.
So I have a 10-year-old child who came home recently asking me what a sigma meant, and I was surprised to find out that it was a descriptor of a lone wolf male and not a brand of kitchen.
Oh, and a sigma male.
Yes.
Right.
And you were talking about social media and the impact it has, and I'd like to know what you think about how that is impacting our children and potentially the future of this kind of conspiracy theory.
What I hope, I mean, maybe I'll end on a positive note, which is that, and this is probably naive positivity, but I hope that one of the reasons why I wanted to write my book, So You've Been Publicly Shamed, which was about the sort of rise of what became known as cancel culture, is because I thought that our young were creating a set of rules for themselves that were just impossibly hard to live up to. You know, as in you say the wrong thing and it could have impact on the rest of your life. Adults were being judged on something that they did when they were children, 20 years earlier, a tweet would come up, you know, all of this stuff, completely irrational behaviour. And I thought, they're going to be felled by their own weapons. And I think that is what's starting to happen. And I think a younger generation is going to come up that's going to be relying less on social media and is going to be starting to think of our fellow humans not as people to, you know, hunt out and ruin, but people to sort of understand and learn from. So I have some hope for the future that, you know, because each generation is a response against the generation that came before. And so I think a younger generation is going to come along with all the new understanding, all the new positive understanding that's come from things like Me Too and Black Lives Matter. So a much more sort of holistic way of understanding the world and all the systemic problems in the world, but will set aside the more draconian, sort of monstrous parts of that. That could quite possibly be naivety on my part and just wishful thinking, but I hope that's how things are going to turn. So I think on that positive note, thank you all so much for coming, and thank you.
From BBC Radio 4, Britain's biggest paranormal podcast is going on a road trip.
I thought in that moment, oh my God, we've summoned something from this board.
This is Uncanny USA.
He says, somebody's in the house, and I screamed.
Listen to Uncanny USA on BBC Sounds or wherever you get your podcasts, if you dare.